Ja.
And why are there Bernie bros and not Bernie hoes?
No, there are.
Did we talk about having edibles at my holiday party?
And that I always underestimated is that men really like breasts.
Do you think I'm a Karen?
Valentine's Day is like New Year's Eve with nuclear weapons.
What you just said was so slut-shaming. And I wanted to
see how it's slut-shaming. Welcome to the Femsplainers. I'm Danielle Crittenden. And I'm releasing a difficult episode in advance of the holidays. It's going to be a break from our usual format, and I thought hard about doing it. This year in particular, so many of us are looking forward to gathering again with friends and family and a more normal, let's hope, truly healthier 2022. But the holiday season at even the best of times can be a lonely, depressing, and mournful period for many, and especially for those who have lost someone they loved. Chairs are missing from the table. There's one less stocking hanging from the mantle. Christmas and New Year's become something you simply have to endure and get through. Hundreds of thousands have lost relatives, friends, family to COVID over the past 18 months. And now, just as the pandemic is receding and life is beginning to renew itself, so have the number of shootings begun to rise again, drastically so. As we reported on a recent episode, more people were shot dead in 2020 than at any time since the 1990s. And the numbers show no sign of relenting during 2021. And unlike with COVID and all its many variants, there seems to be no inoculation on the horizon to combat this epidemic. And it's uniquely an American epidemic. No other country in the Western world comes close to the number of gun deaths that we do. And maybe it's also a uniquely American thing to accept these deaths like bad weather. It rains, it storms, it snows, it floods, whatever. It's outside our windows. It's happening in another city or state. It's mostly beyond our control. That is, until it happens to us. So I'm going to share a couple of stories today from young women who will be approaching the holidays with the quiet fortitude of aching loss. This first is Summer Guymar, a 23-year-old whose journalist mother died while attempting to protect her colleagues from a shooter at the Capital Gazette offices in Annapolis, Maryland. The other is Sari Kaufman, a teenage girl who was able to escape Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida, while shots were still being fired at her friends. Last, we'll also hear from a pastor whose mother was killed at point-blank range by a boyfriend when he was just 5 years old. He now counsels others through these extremely difficult situations. And while these stories are terrible and tragic, you'll be impressed by the courage with which they're told. None of my guests today would, of course, wish this destiny upon them, but they've chosen to speak about it and will continue to speak about it so long as these truly preventable atrocities continue to happen. What may surprise you, as it did me, is that none of these guests were or are anti-gun. They are not, as some gun advocates might callously accuse them of and have, quote, exploiting their stories, unquote, in order to, quote, take guns away from law-abiding citizens. As you'll hear, in each of these instances, a small legal measure, not a sweeping law, might have prevented a gun from falling into the wrong hands, and their family members would still be alive this Christmas. These are measures, too, every law-abiding gun owner should want to advocate for. So I'm grateful to my guests for agreeing to share their stories at this time of the year. Consider it a kind of ghosts of Christmas future if we don't heed their warnings. And their example should be an inspiration to everyone who faces the coming holidays with a sense of loss and trepidation. I hope you'll have the courage to listen to them. I certainly had a hard time recording them. This will be our second to last episode before we break for the season. Next episode will be our official office holiday party, when we'll be joined by some of your favorite regular Femsplainers, and I promise it will be a little lighter in spirit. So after this quick break from a sponsor, I'll be joined by Summer Guymar. Okay, Nat, this ad is for GiveWell. Tis the season of giving, and donating money to help people can be a wonderful and selfless act. But how can you feel confident that your donations are improving or saving lives effectively? You could do weeks of research to find the charities that are out there, what programs they run, how effective those programs are, and how the charity might use your money. Or you could visit givewell.org. There, you'll get a short, vetted list of the best charities they've found at saving or improving lives per dollar. GiveWell spends over 20,000 hours each year researching charitable organizations and only recommends a few of the highest impact evidence-backed charities they've found. Over 50,000 donors have used GiveWell to donate more than $750 million. Rigorous evidence suggests that these donations will save tens of thousands of lives and improve the lives of millions more. And here's the best part. GiveWell is free. GiveWell wants to empower as many donors as possible to make informed decisions about their donations. They publish all of their research and recommendations on their site for free, no sign-up required. They allocate your tax-deductible donation to the charity you choose without taking a cut. I like to give to their Maximum Impact Fund, which allows GiveWell the flexibility to donate to the charities that need it most at any given moment. So if you've never donated to GiveWell's recommended charities before, you can have your donation matched right now up to $250 before the end of the year or as long as matching funds last. To claim your match, go to givewell.org, that's G-I-V-E-W-E-L-L, givewell.org, and pick podcast, and then enter the Femsplainers at checkout. Make sure that they know you heard about GiveWell from the Femsplainers podcast to get your donation matched. Happy holidays. Summer Guymar is the youngest daughter of the late journalist Wendy Williams. Her mother was one of five killed on June 28, 2018, when a gunman stormed the offices of the Capital Gazette in Annapolis, Maryland. The gunman, Jared Ramis, also injured two others as they were trying to escape. Well, what was Ramis's motive? He was angry at the newspaper for publishing an article in 2011 about a case in which he was accused of harassing an acquaintance from high school. Ramos subsequently brought a defamation lawsuit against the newspaper, but a judge dismissed it. Just before the shootings, Ramos sent letters and messages to the Capital Gazette threatening to attack its newsroom and staff. No action was taken. I first came across Summer on TikTok where, in a recent post that went viral, she said every new shooting that she hears about, reads about, brings on PTSD. And now, as you'll hear, she does occasional activism, but mostly she is trying to reclaim some sense of normalcy and joy in her life, things that were brutally taken away from her 3 years ago in June. Summer, welcome to the Femsplainers. Thank you so much for joining me.
Yeah, I'm happy to be here.
Tell us where you are, because you were in Annapolis, but now you're in Wisconsin?
Yes, I'm coming to you from wonderful Wauwatosa, Wisconsin. I live in Milwaukee, though.
In Milwaukee. And what yes. took you there? Work?
It was my boyfriend's job and we moved here, and then he actually never went into the office because of COVID. So we moved here to work from home.
In Milwaukee.
Milwaukee. Yeah, I found a great job outside the house. I think if the two of us were still stuck in the house together, I just don't even know.
Well, how are you going to be spending the holidays this year? You're the youngest of four children, am I right?
Yes.
And how have you been spending the holidays in over the past 3 years?
I actually met my current boyfriend right after my mom was killed. So I've spent a lot of my Christmases with his family. He also has a large family like me. It's really tough with my siblings being so far away and us not really having that common meeting place anymore, which would probably be my mom's house. Yeah. But I have traveled to see them. I spent one Christmas in Italy with my brother right after my mom was killed. And then I'm actually flying to Virginia this afternoon to see my sister and my nephews, because two of my sisters are located in Norfolk right now.
That's good. So before then, your parents were divorced just, I think, 2 years before your mother was killed. Because one of the aspects of your story that I found incredible and horrible were that you were the only child in town when the shooting happened. You were kind of on your own in the family to handle this. Do you mind going back to that day and saying what happened from your perspective?
Sure. Yeah. So one aspect of our family dynamic that my mom was incredibly proud of was that all three of my siblings are in the Navy. So at that time in our lives, the Navy had taken them pretty far away. I think we, at that point, we were Florida, Italy, and Indiana. And then I was still at home in Annapolis, not living with my mom, but, you know, we were close by. And so really it was just me and my mom in the state and in the time zone that we were in. So on the day that she was killed, it was, you know, I relied a lot on my friends that were there, but for the most part, it was me, being the command center, communicating things to my siblings, anything that I heard from the police or from news sources, I was trying to communicate to them. And they were just constantly asking for updates because they're also relying on whatever the news is putting out and whatever I'm telling them. So it was kind of frustrating because for about 4 hours, there weren't really any updates as to what was going on or who
were you
was
in
injured
your
or killed.
At this point, how did you first hear about it?
I left my office at probably 3 p.m. that day, and the shooting happened at 2:32. I was out of the door, freaking out immediately. And so I was actually at the Family Reunification Center for a couple hours, and that was an abandoned Lord and Taylor. Yeah.
And you heard about it on the news, or how were you alerted?
I got a phone call from a family friend, someone who worked downtown as well. Basically with kind of the details that had come out, there's a shooting downtown. And that automatically like alerted me that I want to go check on my mom. And the detail she gave was very vague. She didn't really have any information either. There was just kind of like, there was a shooting, near Bestgate. Yeah. And it's interesting to me because at that time I didn't know it was a mass shooting. I knew very little about the situation, but it just felt like something like astronomical had happened. And so I stopped what I was doing at work and, you know, just went to call my mom. I was like, I'm sure she's fine. Let me just call and make sure she's okay. And it went to voicemail. And it never goes to voicemail. And so that moment, was probably like the, second that I knew something was incredibly wrong. And I couldn't feel her anymore is kind of how I describe it. And so that's when the meltdown happened. And I told myself, I was like, I'm going there right now. I'm going to go see if she's okay myself. I'm going to go to her office. Like there's just something super wrong about this entire situation. And based on news reports, like I went home first, tried to calm down a little bit. And I was watching the news and I could see the helicopter footage. So I knew it was her building where the newspaper was. And I could see her car from the helicopter footage. And a lot of my friends are trying to tell me that she's probably okay, just in a hospital. And I'm like, look, I can see my mom's car. She's not picking up her phone. It's been an hour. She would have contacted me. My mom would have sent a carrier pigeon if she could not have access to her phone. She would have done anything in her power to let us know she was okay. So the fact that we hadn't heard from her, it just told me that it wasn't going to be good news.
So you're at home alone. You're watching this footage, and then you decide you go to the offices, and that's where I guess they tell you about this family reunification center in the Lord and Taylor.
It's a weird story. It's kind of weird because I moved around a lot in a short amount of time and everything felt like slow motion. So I was at work, got the phone call, went home, watched the news for a little bit. Because I was talked out of going to an active crime scene. And then I saw on the news about the family reunification center, and that just seemed like the place that made the most sense. And it was directly across the street from the offices. So it was like, okay, maybe if there's some good news, you know, we're close by. And that way the police can get to you quickly if they need to tell you bad news, was kind of our thought. Was we didn't need them trying to chase us down to give us information. We wanted to be there and be the first people getting information. So I was dispatched to the family reunification center.
And there you waited.
And there I waited. And I honestly can't even properly recall how long I sat there. I would say that the longer I was there, the more it kind of sank in. I was pretty actively avoiding my phone at that time. We were already receiving phone calls from New York Times reporters, and you know, people were finding me on Facebook asking me if I knew anything about my mom, if my mom was okay. So I immediately, this deluge of people trying to contact me is happening. And I just sat there. I mean, the American Red Cross was there. They were handing out, you know, like Gatorade and chicken sandwiches. And I was sick to my stomach. I don't think I ate for days. Like it had sank in so early that I knew she was dead, that the waiting made everything so unbearable. And it delayed my family coming because we were waiting to figure out what was happening. And so really we sat there for a while, and my aunt had driven in from Virginia, and she started calling the shots, thank goodness. And I think she might have been told before me because she was demanding the information. And so eventually a social worker came over to me, and they told me to sit down. And I don't even remember how they told me that she had been killed, but I don't think I really needed them to tell me that. But what stuck out to me is they were asking how I wanted my family to find out. The options were pretty much either I call them or they can have a social worker call them. And that just seemed outlandish to me. So I had to figure out how to put my big girl boots on and tell my family. So that one was pretty tough. Basically I like walked up the broken escalator and like crawled into a closet where they would keep clothes. Like, it was because it was a department store. They just kind of had weird built-ins into the walls. So I literally like crawled into one of those. And I had an Android phone, so I had to call each one of my family members. And I think I got my sister Montana first or second. And she caught me before I could keep going and adding people. I don't even remember this. She told me this later on. Apparently I had like told her to sit down. And I think she asked me if she needed to leave. And I said, yes. And so then I kept adding my family into this group call. So there's like five of us. There's my three siblings, my dad and me. And it's just kind of quiet. They're all waiting for me to tell them something that I think they all knew at that point as well. And I, At some point I got out that mom was one of the victims and she didn't make it. And it got really somehow even quieter. And then I could hear my brother start crying. And basically there was like a lot of crying, and then everyone snapped into family mode and they were like, all right, well, I'm on my way to the airport. Can someone help me get an AmCross message through so that I can get out of Italy? My dad was like, we're getting in the car. We're driving down right now. We'll be there in 14 hours. So it pretty quickly, we all turned it off so that we could logistically get everyone there. And then as soon as we all started arriving, it was just a lot of crying, like unbelievable amounts. It seemed like anytime I saw someone that knew my mom, they would just look at me and I would just, you would just break down. It was so unexpected and so grievous. It just made no sense. And for the longest time, the fact that it was a mass shooting didn't even really register for me, because at first you're just like, you know, my mom's dead. Like, that's someone I can't replace ever. I can't, you know, you can sometimes fill the void, but it's like, holy cow, like this just makes no sense to me. And for the longest time, I didn't even know who the shooter was. I didn't even notice those. I didn't even pay attention to those news stories. I don't even know when I figured out that like there was a specific person that had done that. Everything just is a blur for so long. You don't even understand. And I think that's one of the reasons that it's really important not to share the shooter's face in news stories, is because, you know, the family doesn't need that. The public really doesn't need that information, in my opinion. The person's in jail. So it just becomes white noise when people are trying to remember the victims.
Was it any consolation, not that one wanted consolation of this kind, but that your mother behaved so heroically?
It was, you know, in a way, for a while, before a lot of the details had come out, I kind of envisioned her doing something like that.
Do you want to tell the listeners what she did? And she had taken like an active shooter drill. I hadn't realized.
Yeah,
like
a week or two before.
On her own, or was this part of the newspaper's?
She actually did it through our church.
Oh, okay.
So that day was kind of weird. So she had taken the active shooter training course about a week or two before. And then in March, since this was 2018, she actually went to the March for Our Lives rally in DC. So she was really concerned about mass shootings. She thought, you know, that they needed to be stopped. And so she was trying to educate herself.
Was this something she covered as well as a reporter? Did she write about these things?
Yep. And her last interview was actually a young lady. She was in high school who was part of the March for Our Lives chapter in Annapolis. That was actually her last interview at 2 p.m. that day, was this young woman who was an advocate. And so we're also really grateful that that young woman wasn't in the office at that time.
Oh my God.
But so I don't know if it was the training that my mom had taken, or if it was just my mom being my mom, but when he shot through the glass doors, she ran at him.
She picked up like a recycling bin or something, right?
She picked up her like two trash cans that were next to her desk, and I think she hit him with one, and then I think she was throwing the other one when he shot her. But so if she's credited as slowing him down, he did try and besmirch her in court and say that her actions, you know, didn't stop him, but enough people were able to hide. Six people were able to survive.
There was a long enough pause that it gave others the chance to crawl
behind.
Yeah, it gave
them enough of a distraction.
Filing cabinets.
And I always had a feeling that she had done something. My mom was 6 feet tall.
Wow.
And this was like a bullpen. I went into this office a lot. So once I heard there was a shooting, in her office. I imagined the layout of the building and I imagined where her desk was. And I literally knew that there was no way she wasn't visible because she was so tall and right. it's cubicles. So I just knew that she had either she knew she couldn't hide. So she did something or I don't know. I just always had that feeling. And I actually have a video of myself walking through her office about a year before then. And you can see her look over her cubicle. So that's always what I would see would be she could see who was walking down the hallway because she would just look up over her cubicle. That day is just so strange to me. I can imagine a lot of it, and court really solidified a lot of the things that I had been playing in my mind. I probably made it a little bit worse because now I had actual footage behind it and not imagination.
You went to the trial, obviously. So you watched the whole.
Yeah. The trial was tough. I'm glad it happened. Because sometimes when people will just put in a plea, you never get to see that information. Mm-hmm. So I'm glad I was able to choose to see that information. But it was really hard to watch because there's video footage and pictures and it's gruesome.
Oh God. What about him? The shooter there, he had sent warnings to the newspaper. The newspaper apparently hadn't paid much attention. I mean, also I've worked in newsrooms. So, it's not uncommon to get a lot of crazy threats. Have you ever found out more about that whether there could have been more steps taken?
I'm not sure I can comment on that. Just kind of based on some current litigation happening.
Okay. Yes, got it.
But I will say that he did make threats and they were aware of some of his threats, but he also purposely went under the radar to obtain weapons and to make sure that he could carry out his plan.
Yeah.
So it's a tough situation to be in. I don't know if my mom would, I don't know if I would say that she knew his name, but they had definitely discussed it, at least among management, that this guy was threatening them and it was a little scary. And I guess the biggest clue we have to that is the letters and everything that he sent out that day. Because he sent out letters to the judge that ruled against him. He sent a letter to Eric Hartley, who had written the first article about him. So this was definitely planned out in his head. And I'm glad at least one of the things that went awry that day was my mom being pissed off and running at him because she was yelling at him while she was running at him. And that's very Wendy of her to do. She definitely raised four kids and didn't take shit from anybody. So
tell me about your mom now, not your mom as victim, but your mom is your mom. When you think of her, what do you like to think of?
She was fiery. I don't know how she had so much energy, and she wasn't necessarily a person that gave off an energetic vibe. She just was always doing things. She would go to the gym in the morning, go to work for 10 hours, and then would go out and cover things after that, things in the community that were happening or that she was invited to. And then she would come home, sit down and keep writing until midnight. So she was probably one of the people that was single-handedly keeping the newspaper running based on the sheer amount of stories she would write in a week. And she would pre-write stories that would be due in a month. Cause she would just be I did it. I interviewed them. It's done. And she would do that before vacations. She was so on top of it. That was her, at least, how I viewed her as an adult. Childhood was pretty sweet with her. She was a force. Like, I'm really grateful for how she raised me. You know, it's never going to be perfect with your parents. I'm not going to say she was a perfect mom. There's probably rants out there that I may have made about her. And, you know, that's always how I'm going to feel about a parent. You're never going to do everything right.
And by the way, that's, you should, like,
yeah,
you know, remembering someone as an angel is not true to their memory.
But she loved the holidays. I have really fond memories of, you know, what we would do for the holidays. We would take trips to New York, which is like where my mom worked for most of her life. It's where she moved after college. It's where my parents met. It's where all of us were born. So we would take annual trips there. We would go see the windows. We would make friendship bread and all these sourdoughs, and we would make pesto and pasta sauce and can them and freeze them and give out this time of year. And we would dip Oreos in chocolate, and it would take like hours and hours and hours. And we would make hundreds of Oreos dipped in chocolate, 'cause my mom was incensed by how expensive a single chocolate dipped Oreo was at Godiva. And she literally would not stop telling the story.
She was like,
I can do that. It's literally just dipped in chocolate. And she always loved making like chocolates around this time of year. And I honestly, like, growing up, didn't have the heart to tell her that I don't like chocolate. Like, I like it enough, but I definitely didn't need an entire solid chocolate miniature Christmas tree. That would definitely sit in my closet for like a year, 'cause I would just never eat it. But we still make the chocolate dipped Oreos darn near every year. I can't remember a year we didn't. And I don't eat those. I do not like chocolate dipped Oreos, but I make them, kind of just like as a memory of her. I am a bit of a hoarder, and I still have the last jar she gave me.
Oh,
I like froze them, a couple years ago, and I just keep them in my freezer. There's like five in there. I think someone ate some, but yeah, they're like 4-year-old Oreos that I just have in my freezer, 'cause those are the last ones my mom made for me.
How have you been now? Like, have you, I mean, you've had to tell your story, and you doing some really incredible TikToks, which is how I came across you talking. You spoke about how I think it was your most recent one, of how every time a shooting happens, you feel it.
Yeah. It's tough. It's an empathy I never realized I would develop for complete strangers. And it's just every time there's one in the media, it sends me back, 'cause I'm like, oh my God, these people are in for some of the worst times in their life. And a lot of people don't recover from that. So then you worry, you're like, what's the toll going to be on their family? And it makes you realize that you can't look at someone and know that they've been through something. 'Cause I wouldn't say that a lot of like my coworkers look at me and realize what I do in my free time and the advocacy I do. So it's just creating this giant network of people that are incredibly traumatized by gun violence. And even violence in general, especially living in Wisconsin, and what happened at a parade here in Waukesha a couple of weeks ago. I think violence in general really shakes you when you've been through gun violence.
Yeah. And the advocacy that you do, has that helped you deal with your own grief? Or, you know, would you rather like, thanks, but I would rather have not had to do this. This was not the path I would have necessarily chosen. I mean, you're young, and you've had this thing kind of thrust upon you.
Yeah, I would say if maybe my mom had survived, I probably would have followed her lead 100%. She would have been way more influential and better at this than I am. But also,
I mean, you would have got involved in it anyway, because she was already involved. Yeah,
because she, you know, it's something she's gone through. But it's tough being an advocate for gun violence. You don't always see a lot of advocates for gun violence, because it's terrible. It's not exactly rewarding. I'm constantly having to talk about what I went through. And I'm not saying it's, you know, horrible to recount it. It's not fun, but I'm constantly recounting it.
Yeah.
And so a lot of people choose to just recede from the spotlight, and that's totally fair. I would not have chosen myself to be a person in the spotlight. I was very happy with no followers mm-hmm. before everything happened. But also knowing how publicized our shooting was and how people were going to look for someone to speak out about it, and how just the awareness I have, at least from my mom being a journalist, that this is probably going to continue being a big deal, at least in our town, for a long time, then we need to take the reins on that and steer it towards a discussion on how to prevent it. And that's really tough. It's one of those things where, you know, it's almost one of those, like, if I don't do it, no one else will. And that's not for the entire gun violence prevention community, but it's just, you have to grab onto the wave of people knowing about it and steer them into a knowledgeable direction of how, even though they're not affected by it, they can be an advocate and discuss it with people and share the story so that other people become aware of it. And it's probably really, really tough because a lot of mass shootings aren't that publicized. So of course ours has this name recognition to it, mm-hmm. but a lot of people don't have that luxury of
right. It's like
being able to discuss
two or three people shot in a parking lot and it just.
Right. And so if someone.
It's just so frequent now where.
Yeah. So that's why I'm like, I have to take hold of the public knowledge about the event and use that for good instead of using it as an extreme burden. And it's also why it fell on me, because my siblings are all in the military. They can't say the things that I say.
Yeah.
For risk of losing their jobs. And so I'm also speaking for them. But I'm speaking for them.
The fact that they're in the military, I mean, that do you get pushback for what you're saying from people who are pro-gun? I mean, you come from a background where, as you point out, your siblings are in the military. You've gone through this awful, extraordinary experience, but do people ever become abusive with you about that or try and characterize your views in such a way that, I mean, you know, like, oh, you just want to take guns away from everybody kind of thing is what one typically hears.
Oh my gosh. People have lots of opinions and will tell me all about them on my posts frequently, which I don't think a lot of people realize that we are a military family. We are familiar with weapons and handgun. Like, I'm sorry, we are familiar with firearms.
Yeah.
Obviously that's something required of their training. So my siblings and I are very, we see kind of both sides in a way. Mostly in the respect and understanding of firearms, not in some of the more extreme views. I would say a lot of people make assumptions about what exactly I'm advocating for. I don't always outright say what laws I'm looking to change or this or that. So people make assumptions that I either want to take all guns away, that I want to make it impossible for them to get them. And really, my path has been pretty clear for most of my advocacy. That's I'm working on changing how people see Maryland gun laws, even though I don't live there anymore, because I think that Maryland's gun laws are what allowed my mom's killer to get his hands on a weapon. So I see this as a smaller, singular issue that obviously expands to a larger issue, but I'm trying to start small. And I'm not trying to take away everyone's guns. I used to shoot guns for fun. That used to be one of my hobbies. It's not anymore. Now I don't enjoy it. But, you know, assuming that I am just a scared liberal, that's never touched a gun in my life is an incorrect assumption about me. And I, even before my mom died, I was aware of issues with gun laws, even though I was a gun owner. And I made a presentation about that in college, like the semester before my mom was killed, about how one of the issues facing gun owners is gun show loopholes, where it's putting guns in the hands of people that shouldn't have them. And it's making it worse for gun owners, because what's the point of legally obtaining a gun and going through a background check if you can buy it out of some guy's trunk?
Right.
So, like, I think gun owners can be part of the conversation on how to reduce gun violence. I think that's very logical.
And they
logical.
Should. I mean, that's they the should. Point. That's the point. If you're, you know, a responsible gun owner, that's who you
would. But it's become this assumption from people that the only people that want to make it more difficult to get guns or make it harder to have mass violence and gun violence would be people that don't have guns. And I think that's a very naive assumption to make about any activist, would be that they don't have a varying background or varying opinions.
Right.
So it's just been very strange. Or people will tell me that I'm blaming the tool and not the person. And that just goes back to how they obtain the tool.
Right.
It matters, and it does matter. And I think it's becoming convoluted, and in some ways it feels like we're making progress. You know, sometimes in my comments section, actual like intelligent conversations occur where people just have questions about why people want to change something specific, even though it might seem minute. And you know, sometimes that's really nice to see, and other times it's just people telling me that I'm stupid and that my mom should have been carrying. And I always go back to the fact that if everyone has a right to carry, it means you have a right not to carry, and not carrying isn't an invitation to get shot.
Right.
So even if my mom did have a concealed carry permit, she wouldn't have carried a gun because she didn't want to.
Do we really want to live in a world where you, yeah, every time you go into a Starbucks, you know, you need a gun should have one on you?
Especially working in customer service, I cannot imagine dealing with an upset customer who might just have free access to a concealed weapon that I'm unaware of. I don't want someone to threaten me, and I don't want to have to take lethal force against anyone ever.
Yeah. Summer, how can people find you? You're on TikTok. It's at Summer.
So it's at Summer Lee, SummerLeigh.
LeigH. Yes.
Yep. That's not how I actually spell my name, but that's the username that was available.
And which organization are you involved with, Benny, at the moment?
I wouldn't say I am a card carrying member of any organization, mostly because then I would have to probably publicly speak more. Now, I would urge anyone that wants to support curbing gun violence to reach out to the local Moms Demand Action chapter.
Yeah.
Almost every city, town has one. You'd be very surprised. You can generally find them on Facebook and request to join. And if you don't want to be part of that organization, then give blood. Because that was something my mom was very passionate about. It's something I do. She got up to 10 gallons with the Red Cross, which is a lot. That's like 80 blood donations. Yeah. I'm at 3 gallons, so I'm catching up. But if you're
great,
not
great
ready,
point.
Then donate blood or donate at your local hospital, because there is always a need to donate blood.
Wow. What a great idea. Summer, thank you. Thank you so much. You're so impressive. Your own story is impressive, of just what you've been through, how you've come out of it, and what you're doing now. So again, thank you for joining. Have, I hope, a Merry Christmas with your family. And
thank you. I know I'm excited to see my nephew. He's a year old.
Giving blood is such an easy and good thing to do, and she has inspired me to give it this season. So, and giving blood can be an incredible gift to someone. Summer, by the way, told me after she hung up that the baby nephew she is going to spend this Christmas with would have been her mother's first grandchild. My next guest is Sari Kaufman. She survived the February 14, 2008 mass shooting at Marjorie Stoneman Douglas High School in Parkland, Florida. 17 students and faculty were killed that day. Sari became one of the lead organizers of the Parkland March for Our Lives event. She is now 19 years old and a political science major at Yale. And Sari recently started an organization called My Vote Project, which creates digital voter guides so young voters can know who is running for office in their communities. After experiencing the shooting and seeing how politics is just so intertwined with what happened and the inaction that followed, she has said, it made me want to go into politics. So let's bring on Sari. When it comes to feminine health issues, we're often embarrassed or ashamed to talk about them, and especially the one I'm about to bring up, which, if I'm guessing, if it was a male problem, I might even boast about it. I'm talking about odor from down there. Yes. Okay, I'll say it. Vaginal odor. Who are you going to call? Well, when Deanna Seymour Story, CEO and founder of women's wellness brand PhD Feminine Health, was working in the pharmaceuticals industry 6 years ago, she discovered no one. There was no one you could call except your doctor. And as she said, quote, during that time, I got so frustrated getting the same medications and having really disappointing results. I was in search of a holistic solution for vaginal issues, but it was imperative to me to find an ingredient that was backed by published clinical data. So Seymour started researching boric acid and came across dozens of studies that had been done on this ingredient, but no one was manufacturing it commercially. Thus, PhD was born. Boracic acid is a natural compound found in seawater and has been recommended by medical professionals for decades as a safe, holistic alternative. PhD is now the number one doctor-recommended brand of boric acid vaginal suppositories. When you have feminine issues, you want a solution immediately. PhD offers trustworthy feminine care products that actually work. Plus, you'll be supporting a female-owned and founded company. So these days, PhD believes that self-care is crucial to your overall well-being. Give the gift of self-care and love to yourself. Register now at phdfemininehealth.com/win to receive a free lifestyle subscription box from our friends at Bombay and Cedar, which contain vegan and cruelty-free deluxe-size beauty and lifestyle products, a retail value of over $100, plus a $500 Visa gift card. So go to phdfemininehealth.com, phdfemininehealth.com/win, and you'll also get 20% off all products right now. Use code FEM, F-E-M, FEM, to get 20% off at phdfemininehealth.com/win. Sari, welcome to the Femsplainers. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Let's talk about where you're sitting right now. You're in your dormitory at Yale.
Yes, I know. The background's a little dark, but I'm a sophomore at Yale, so I'm in my dorm right now.
And you have become a very prominent face of what happened at Parkland. Tell me, this was probably not a face you wanted to have, but tell us where you were and what happened to you at the time.
Yeah, so I'm 19 years old now, but I was 15 years old when the shooting happened. So I was a sophomore in high school, and it was Valentine's Day. So my mom was dropping me off at school. You know, I was looking forward to seeing who I would get a carnation from. And then we have four periods. So I went to my second period. It was my chem class. And the fire alarm went off, which was a little odd during that time, but we didn't think much of it. So it was just a fire drill in second period. And we went outside, we came back. But then when it came to fourth period, we had another fire alarm go off. And at that point, you know, to have two fire alarms in one day, we had a feeling something was off. So I went outside, and I was luckily outside of the building where the shooting was happening, but close enough to hear everything and to hear the sounds and what was going on. So at first we heard the gunshots, but Parkland was one of the safest cities in the US. So, you know, I didn't really think anything of it. I thought it was like a Valentine's Day thing. But then, you know, looking back, it all seems at the same moment, but I remember hearing and seeing a video of one of my friends in the building, and a horrible and graphic video of a girl laying on the floor and she was shot. And at that moment, everything clicked and I realized what was going on in the building right
was
near
this,
me.
Was this a video being sent real time to you?
Yeah. I was on my lacrosse team. So we had a lacrosse group chat and we were figuring out where everyone was and what was going on. And it seemed at the same time I was getting, you know, thousands of texts and realizing what was happening. So once we realized what was happening, we started running from our school and the police and administrators helped us run away from campus. And I went to a local restaurant and watched on TV what was going on at my school and just seeing first it was 2 dead and I couldn't believe it. And then, you know, 17 dead. And I still almost 4 years later, I can remember the exact day. So.
Yeah. What is it like to hear those sounds? Like what do, when you say you thought maybe it was a Valentine's Day thing, I assume you're not used to hearing gunshots.
Yeah, no, that was one of the first times I heard a gunshot. And, you know, in that moment, there were so many emotions, so I don't remember exactly. But today, looking back, it just is a lot of anger that as a 15-year-old in high school, I had to hear gunshots in my own school when I was, you know, in debate class. Like that shouldn't be happening and it shouldn't continue to happen so many years later when there are preventative policies that we can put in place to stop these school shootings from happening.
Did you know were any of these people who were shot your friends?
Yeah, Parkland's a pretty tight-knit community. So a lot of the people I knew or had friends who knew them. And Alyssa Audaheff, she was on my debate team and in one of my math classes. So yeah, losing her was really hard. And again, especially at a young age, understanding and trying to understand at least like what death is and when it happens to another person so young has definitely affected my life today.
Did you have to, what sort of therapy and trauma follow-up did you have?
Yeah, well, interestingly, afterwards, I didn't do too much work and I went kind of right into activism and I kind of saw that as my way for therapy. But now that I'm in college and a little more mature and understanding what type of event that was and how it affects me, now I'm starting to go through the process and, you know, getting help. But I think, you know, anyone who goes through that and just in general, getting help is important.
It's interesting you say that it changes as you get older and mature, that to be 15 when something like this happens at your school, I mean, it's cliche to say it's surreal or unreal, but at some level, maybe even your maturity level to cope with it at that point immediately, while you need time almost for it to, I assume it just keeps coming back to you in different ways each year at a different age.
Yeah, exactly. And just the small things of, you know, being excited to go to homecoming, but then remembering, you know, a lot of my classmates can't come because they're not here anymore, or graduation, things like that, where, you know, it should just be a normal celebration and being able to enjoy it. I wasn't able to enjoy it because the shooting definitely overshadowed my whole high school experience. So it's difficult getting like a part of your young self taken away from you.
One of the things I was very surprised about at the time is, aside from the fact of the incident, was how much political pushback you kids got when you became activists. And a lot of it was personal. I remember David Hogg getting like mocked on television. What were some of the things you experienced?
Yeah, luckily I do not think I got it to the same extent as David Hogg. But for me, you know, a lot of times if I'm speaking somewhere or the conversations that happen afterwards, or if I write an op-ed and looking at the comments, you know, just again, at a young age and getting some a lot of times, you know, men commenting like, how dare you, or, you know, your mom just dropped you off in a minivan. You should go back to school. You shouldn't be talking about these issues. It's not your place. I think that was a lot of the comments kind of emphasizing the age and therefore like taking away our credibility to be able to talk about gun violence prevention solutions. And, you know, I think after going through a shooting, that gives you a lot of credibility to be able to discuss that these aren't just statistics you see in the news, but there are stories behind these statistics and a lot of people affected.
Did you have any personal knowledge of the shooter or know him?
I personally did not know the shooter. Afterwards, I heard stories from my friends who would tutor him or who encountered him in different ways throughout middle and high school. But I personally didn't know him.
And what did they say about him?
There were definitely a lot of warning signs. For example, one of my friends said that when she was tutoring him, I think this was in middle school, he like showed her the knife that he had on him. And this was just middle school. So, you know, I think that's part of the issue here, right? A lot of times, most of the times, these shooters see warning signs before. And I think that's also a conversation we need to start talking about more and intervening quickly, because a lot of times these students show these warning signs and need to get the right help before they decide to, you know, go and do a school shooting.
I mean, you have become, you did join the activism early on, of course, but you've also continued it at Yale, correct? It's made you, I think you founded a group about going into voting and education. Do you want to talk about that?
Yeah, so I founded My Vote Project, which is a nonpartisan organization that provides voter education, especially to young people. So it's myvoteproject.com, and someone can type in their zip code into our website and then learn about their candidates, specifically local candidates, before an election. And now we have about 300 volunteers across the country. And I saw this connection because, you know, a lot of times people don't know that, like, their sheriff is an elected position or the school board. Mm-hmm. And there were just a lot of levels, a lot of mistakes on those various levels that helped lead to the shooting. So just emphasizing the importance of local politics and for young people to understand who's running in their local area, I think is another way that we can tackle gun violence as well.
Would you ever feel frustrated, or you're young enough to feel optimistic about your generation and getting changed through?
Yeah, I just really hope it doesn't have to rely on this generation to pass these laws. You know, I think this generation would, but it needs to come sooner, because, you know, we continue to see each community getting impacted. And when I saw the Michigan shooting happen, it's re-traumatizing to me and a lot of my friends in my community. And I know a lot of communities all over the country feel the same way. So I just really hope there's action soon and lawmakers feel the urgency to start passing gun violence prevention policies.
Do you feel what you went through has brought you a purpose that maybe was unexpected? Or is it something you resent? Like, maybe I didn't want to have to be this activist, you know, I would have rather have done ballet or something. How does the sort of role that you've been thrust into affect you?
Yeah, no, I've actually been talking about this recently. I think I'm in a little bit of a dilemma because I see this work as really important, but, you know, the only reason why I'm doing this work is because I was kind of forced into it because of the shooting. So, yeah, I think this work is really important and I'll continue to do it, but there's definitely some anger that I have that I feel like I have to be doing this because mm-hmm. gun violence continues to happen.
And do you, what happens when almost daily, as we do, you read about another shooting? How do you personally react to that?
Yeah, it's been really difficult. It definitely puts me back to that day and what happened to my friends, and brings back all of those emotions. So a lot of times when something like this happens, I try to stay off social media and try to protect myself. But sadly, since it's happening so frequently, it's difficult to do that.
Does it affect you more over the holidays? Do you think about it more? I mean, it happened on Valentine's Day, so I assume that that's always going to be a very mixed holiday for you, as it were. And how do you look at going through holidays like this? Is it something you're able to put aside, or does it affect you?
Yeah. Yeah. I, definitely still try to enjoy the holidays. I think, especially during Thanksgiving, when, you know, a lot of my friends and family were sitting around us at the table, just thinking that, you know, a lot of families in my community can't have that because they don't have their kid anymore. I think that's like the hardest part for me on the holidays, just another reminder of what was taken away from us in our community. And yeah, I don't think I'll be able to enjoy Valentine's Day probably ever, but the other holidays I still try to enjoy.
All right. Well, Sari, thank you so much. Thank you for coming on. Thank you for the work you do and have inadvertently had to do. It's very important and we appreciate it. And I thank you for being such an articulate, you know, spokeswoman of yourself.
Thank you. And thank you for highlighting this issue, because I think obviously it's really important that we keep talking about it.
All right. Thank you. Thank you so much, Sari. You take care.
Thank you.
Hey guys, it's Melissa Gorga from Melissa Gorga on Display, and I am very excited to give you a little look into episode 2. I am going to be talking to New York Times best-selling author Dave Quinn, who wrote the book with all the juicy scoop on all the Real Housewives. Dave, I'm so excited to talk to you.
I am thrilled to be here, Melissa, and I have to say, you have so much behind the scenes that happened on The Real Housewives in New Jersey that you've never spoken about before. So I'm ready to get you to open up about all those things. Let's make amends for the tea you didn't spill when we talked in the book, because you were so nice to everybody. And I promise you, Melissa, I'm not going to sing On Display to you over and over again, but just know that in my head right now, that's what's playing on repeat.
Of course it is. What else would be playing in your head right now? Okay, listeners, make sure you listen to episode 2 of Melissa Gorga On Display.
Okay, if Sari and Summer are both remarkable examples of young women whose early journeys into adulthood were changed indelibly by tragedy and how they chose to cope with it, part through action, the story of my next guest is quite different. Pastor Lorenzo Neal's mother and nephew were victims of gun violence in 1980 and 2016. He is the current pastor at the New Bethel African Methodist Episcopal Church in Jackson, Mississippi. And in the community in which he grew up, as we'll hear, gun violence was all too prevalent and continues to be. He'll tell us how he coped and copes, and how he helps others to cope, especially through the holidays. Let me bring on Pastor Lorenzo Neal. Ritual is the multivitamin company you know and trust, not least because it was created by a woman, Katarina Schneider, who wouldn't settle for less than the truth. She founded Ritual with the belief that better health begins with better ingredients, with no unnecessary ingredients, and with nutrients in their best forms. Ritual has done clinical studies and works in collaboration with an advisory board of medical doctors, nutritionists, and scientists. Well, now Ritual has launched a line of protein powders. Protein powders can feel intimidating in the no pain, no gain way, and their formula is opaque, not just because they're a powder. But the truth is, deep down, as in cellular level deep, we all need protein. And it's about more than just muscles. So Ritual's team of scientists reimagined protein from the ground up and inside out, from how it's made to who it's for and why it's needed. The result is a delicious plant-based protein offered in 3 premium formulations for distinct life stages and unique nutrient needs, all made with the same high standards approach and commitment to traceability that Ritual is known for. So whether you're doing reps or just more into dog walks, essential protein is here to shake things up. And I know, as a woman in my 50s who works out regularly, I've often wondered about taking a protein supplement, but I haven't understood fully why I should or what form of it would be best for me. And I think that's what I love most about Ritual products. Ritual's protein is made with nutrients to support bones, brains, and muscles, and help maintain muscle mass as we age. Its clean, plant-based formulas are specifically created to support nutrient needs of different life stages, 18 plus, pregnancy and postpartum, 50 plus, and offers 20 grams of pea, that's as in PEA, protein, plus a complete amino acid profile, And it's designed to help fill commentary dietary gaps. And maybe best of all, it's a protein powder with good taste. Its delicious handcrafted vanilla flavor is made from a direct from farmer vanilla bean extract sustainably harvested in Madagascar. And there are no added sugar or sugar alcohols. And like all ritual products, essential protein is soy-free, gluten-free, and formulated with non-GMO ingredients. So why not shake up your ritual? To make trying something new less scary, Ritual offers a money-back guarantee if you're not 100% in love with their new protein powders. Plus, my listeners get 10% off during your first 3 months. Just visit ritual.com/femsplain to add essential protein today. That's ritual.com/femsplain, and you'll get 10% off during your first 3 months. Lorenzo, welcome to the Femsplainers. Thank you for taking this time to come on.
No problem. Thank you for having me.
Well, you've been preaching for a long, long time. Let's talk a bit about your personal story and your background, that you lost your mother when you were 5 years old.
Yes, I lost my mother, Sharon Louise Jackson Neal. She was 25 years old, mother of four boys, myself, and I have two other living siblings. I had another one pass away, who was also murdered. She was 25 years old in 1980 when she lost her life to an act of domestic violence that involved a gun. I was 5 years old, and so I've been sharing that story about her loss for the last 40 plus years.
How can you tell us, I mean, who was the person who knew her and killed her? It wasn't your father?
No. My mother was separated. She was separated from her husband at the time. And the person that she was involved with, I guess it was one of those, if I can't have you, no one can. He was an older gentleman, and he decided that her life was not as valuable to others if he couldn't have her explicitly. And he took her life.
And were you there at the time? Did you see this as a boy? Were you?
You know, it's interesting. I have memories of being there and witnessing the event. And my relatives assert that we were not. My younger brothers, I have two younger twin brothers. They were there. They were only 3 years old. My mom's siblings say my brother and I, my older brother and I, were not there. Yet both of us have very vivid memories of the event. But there are certain, recollections that I still have, both prior to her death and following her death. I vividly remember her funeral service, vividly remember that, vividly remember the proceedings, the judicial proceedings afterwards. So if I remember all that, I'm quite sure that the other recollection was just as valid.
You're 5 years old. How is this explained to you of what's happened?
I do not recall, honestly, how it was explained. My mother's parents took us in and raised us as their own children, but we grew up in an environment where it was not discussed. We understood that she had been murdered. We understood all of that, but it was, they didn't languish on all the other stuff. And it's not like they were trying to shield us from it. But they just raised us in a way that we were aware enough to know that her passing was violent and tragic, but aware, shielded enough to not experience the trauma of that.
Right. Were you in a community where there was a lot of violence? Where were we?
Well, I grew up in a hood. Yeah.
Yeah.
there was, but this is during the '80s. So at that time, there was not a lot of gun violence. I'm sure there was a lot of domestic violence, but it was not a lot of gun violence.
This is in Jackson, you grew up?
No, this is in Louisiana, Monroe, Louisiana.
Okay.
Yeah, I currently pastor in Jackson, Mississippi. Yeah. But this happened in Monroe, Louisiana. There was not much gun violence as I've done research over this, and you know, there were several murders that involved guns during that year, but it wasn't a big deal.
And why do you think that is? What do you think has changed between then and now?
I don't have an answer to that. I want to say culture, accessibility to guns, but you know, guns have always been accessible. And I grew up knowing where my grandfather's weapons were, and mm-hmm. he kept them secure, but secure was under the bed in a old Crown Royal bag.
Wow.
But we knew not to touch them. We knew, you know, none of that. And he also trained us on how to shoot weapons. You know, we went hunting and we did all that. So we learned about gun responsibility and all of that at a young age. But I just think it's just some cultural shifts. Like I was about to say, by the time I was coming of age in the end of the 80s, going into the 90s, you know, it was different perspective on guns, you know, shifting from using guns retaliatory with gangs and reinforced by the good old gangster rap music where you loved to listen to back then and we still listen to now. So that kind of shifted, you know, greater accessibility to guns has always been there.
But you said you've lost others as well to gun violence.
I've lost my 18-year-old nephew, Kevin Neal Jr., was killed in 2016, my oldest brother's son. I lost a 14-year-old student. I was a teacher. I was a band director. Yay! Yeah. And 2008, one of my students, 14-year-old, Dontario Henderson, was killed in an accidental shooting with another student playing with guns that was not secure and accidentally shot him. And I had to...
And how was your nephew? How was your nephew killed?
He was killed in the act of gun violence. He was killed. I guess you could say it was a robbery going bad. Someone was attempting to rob him and his friends. And he was able to stave off of it for a little bit, but they took his life. One of my younger brothers, Emmanuel, who is a twin, they were twin. He was killed not by gun violence, but he was stabbed. And that was in 2010.
You're a religious man. How do you process all this violence that has been so personally close to you?
Well, of course, my faith does play a large role in that. It does. But I've secured counseling, of course. I understand trauma. As a therapist myself, I understand trauma. And I've been able to, I love the fact that I have a great family support system that, like I said earlier, growing up shielded us enough to make us aware of what happened, but kept us from the trauma. You know, they gave us great encouragement. They I don't even know if they realized that they used techniques to help us cope that I learned when I was going through my doctoral program, you know, in counseling. And I was like, well, I already know this. I've seen this in action. That's what my family did. My grandparents did. So they gave us coping skills and allowed us for outlets, gave us space for outlets to express that. And of course, my faith community plays a great role in that, not just because of the scriptures, but because you get to see people's faith in action during seasons like this. They are fully aware of how the sense of loneliness and grief is more impactful during this season of the holidays. And so that undergirding also is present. And as a pastor, I don't have to do anything. It's just because of the understanding of community that we have and faith that they are able to undergird that for me when I need it, instead of me having to do it for them. Yeah.
Have you had to counsel a lot of your community over?
Oh, yes. Losses?
Does this happen? Yeah. How often does this happen, would you say?
Well, unfortunately, this year we've had more in Jackson, Mississippi. We've had more incidents of homicides by gun than ever before. And there's been a lot of comforting I've had to do some of those families. I have no direct relationship with, but because of my work in survivor advocacy and gun violence prevention, I'm able to minister to them and share this sense of connection with them. And with grief, as across the spectrum of grief, helping people to understand that they are not alone in the experience of grief. And you may know the 5 or 6 or 8 steps of whatever they say grief. I've disregard that sometimes because they never manifest in the process. You know, this is a marathon, it's not a sprint. You have to learn to live with the agony of the grief that you will experience across your spectrum of life. But in some ways, it's heightened at times, you know. And for me, it's usually heightened during the holiday season. For whatever reason, I have yet to fully understand, but I now have more coping skills to know that when this time comes around this season, I'm like, okay, I know what to do to combat any negative grieving emotions I may experience. And so part of my role now is empowering other individuals who experience grief, especially the grief from the violent loss of someone by gun violence. It's a different kind of grief. It's a different kind of emotion that comes with that. And I'm able and blessed to be able to serve as a grief facilitator through Every Town Survivor Network as a to be able to help those persons coping specifically with grief as a result of gun violence.
So what are some of those coping skills? Why is gun death different from other types of grief you might have?
Okay, let me start with the last one, the latter. Yep. Gun violence, and I'll put gun violence in automobile violence and death pretty much the same, because they're sudden and unexpected. And when you add persons who have lost loved ones and gun violence that involve mass shootings, school shootings, things of that nature, there's an extra layer of trauma that comes with that, secondary trauma that comes with that, and grief, because there's always this sense of guilt, survivor's guilt, that maybe we could have done more, maybe if we had been there or something like that. And that compounds the grief. And so some of the coping skills that we try to help those persons utilize in this is, one, to get them a relief of a sense of guilt, whatever it may be that accompanies specifically the grief from gun violence. Because, for example, if I'm a gun owner, and I am a gun owner, it's like, well, why would I have a gun now? Why should I have a gun now? I just, you know, maybe this could happen to us. Mm-hmm. And it's kind of like that. So we want to direct their awareness of the guilt that they are experiencing is an emotion that can be better understood, one, and does not have to be a heightened emotion to where it's overwhelming, but that it can be a passing moment where you can experience it and then say, okay, yeah, I understand. I feel like I could have done more. I feel like I should have been there, but I wasn't, and I was unable. So I can, you know, be released from that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's one. The second one is finding something to not just articulate the grief, but finding activities that are positively reinforcing of positive emotions. Things, you know, if you have a hobby, you know, take up a hobby if you don't have one. Or, you know, we don't really encourage people to reflect on the good times because that sometimes brings up emotions associated with memories that can lead to a compounded grief. Mm-hmm. So you want them to lean into something more fruitful for them, because now they are the one living and they have to put in the effort to ensure that their living is one that is fruitful, empowering, liberating for those around them. If you're a parent who's lost a child to gun violence, you can hold on to the memory of the child, but if that your child had children, then, you know, you raise the children to be aware of their parent and to celebrate them and to say, look, this is who you come from and this is what you have. They give things you have, something like that. If you're a sibling who's lost, whatever your role may have been, just a friend, you want to find ways where you can not only recognize the value of that individual's life who is no longer with us, but make yours just as valuable without being narcissistic, you know what mm-hmm. I'm saying?
Yeah.
You want to emphasize that it's not all about you, but you had a role in their life and they're now their life is a part of you and your story. And you're only as valuable as your story is. Or your story is only as valuable as you are. So you need to put emphasis on self, not being selfish, but being more self-aware and how to allow that individual's legacy to flow through you, to empower others, to liberate others from this overwhelming grief.
And is that how you have coped? How do you greet the holidays now? I mean, obviously the loss of your mother was a long time ago, but the loss of your mother never goes away.
No, it doesn't. But over these last years, I've developed a lot of coping mechanisms for me. Last year, of course, we were all in the same state of grief mm-hmm. because of COVID. But last year, the first year, I put up a Christmas tree, a holiday tree, mm-hmm. you know, and just getting that, first purchasing it, because, you know, like, oh, this is a waste of money, but purchasing it, assembling it, because it's a fake tree, but I like it. Mm-hmm. Assembling it and then decorating it was such a wonderful experience, a rewarding experience and an uplifting experience. I, you know, I shared on social media, but I was like, wow, I did that, you know? And so that was one of the ways for me to celebrate last year. But over the years, you know, I've gone out, my most cherished tradition was going to a movie during the holiday season. I'm going to at least two movies. One is after Thanksgiving and the other one is on Christmas Day or somewhere. Right. That was my ritual.
Well, actually, I can say this because I'm Jewish, but that's also a very Jewish thing to do on Christmas Day. The Chinese food and then the movie. It's like filled with like Jewish theater goers. No, that's very helpful. And do you have family now, or do you have children?
No, I don't. It's just me and my little dude Jackson, my very, very spoiled Chihuahua Terrier mix. And I'm surprised he's quiet right now.
It's quieter than my email alerts.
Yeah. He's my buddy, and we celebrate together. I try to sneak him into the theater. They won't let him. I was like, hey, he's my service doll. He's my support.
Well, he is, it sounds like.
Oh yeah, he is.
Well, I really appreciate you sharing your story and sharing your advice for getting through the holidays. Is there any advice you can give to us who might not be aware of the grief and loneliness around us at times?
Yeah, just the holiday season offers us a lot of nuances of humanity. When I say nuances, we get a glimpse into the joy, we get and give a glimpse into the sadness, but we don't usually see the totality of all of that. You know, if we watch holiday movies, they're going to give us this happy ending kind of thing. But if we watch the news, they're going to give us this, oh, beware, doom kind of thing. And we as humans have to find the balance in that, because every day, every someone is experiencing grief on different levels. And we just have to be more aware, and we definitely have to be more sensitive, be more aware that during this time, you know, if you're going to be a cheerful giver, and if you're going to celebrate the holidays in whatever manner you're going to celebrate, remember there are still humans who, as they're trying to celebrate, are still grieving in that process. Mm-hmm. And just be aware, and just try to be as humanly as you can to others.
All right. Well, that's a great message. Thank you. Thank you so much, Lorenzo. I really appreciate you coming on and giving us that ministerial advice, which is very much needed at this time of year. Well, wishing everybody a safe, healthy, happy holidays this year. As I mentioned at the beginning, we'll have a happier holiday special next episode before we break for the season. I hope you join us. I thank you for listening to this entire episode, and we'll see you next time. Thanks for listening. The Femsplainers is a weekly podcast carried on the Podcast One Network. Matt Frum produces and edits our audio and video. You can follow us on Twitter and FB at Femsplainers and on Instagram at Femsplainers Podcast. We love hearing from you. You can reach out to us via email at contact@femsplainers.com. You'll find all our episodes and more information about me and the podcast at femsplainers.com. And remember, we rely on your donations to keep this podcast going. So please consider supporting us at patreon.com/femsplainers.